You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, SFU's community radio station, broadcasting live from Burnaby, BC.
Welcome to Electronic Intifada Radio. I'm Nora Barrows Friedman. On this episode, questions and answers. Ahmed Al-Naouk tells us how young writers in Gaza are feeling after 2 years of ongoing genocide.
The people in Gaza, they have been living in tents for the past 2 years. Floods, rain, genocide, killing, murder, starvation. And I say language now fails us. Language fails us. It fails the Palestinians in Gaza. There are no words that can describe what is really happening in Gaza. No words can describe what the Palestinians in Gaza are feeling right now.
Evacuated from Gaza earlier this year, Palestinian journalist Abu Bakr Abed speaks of hope.
I think I've lost a lot since leaving Gaza. I've really, really lost a lot. As I saw hope in Gaza amid all that devastation, despair, and death, I can also see hope here.
And on the Resistance Report, John Elmer tells us about the Israeli assassination of the head of the Qassam Brigade's media apparatus.
Abu Obeida was assassinated while visiting his family. 11 civilians were killed, including a number of his children were killed in that assassination.
This is Electronic Intifada Radio. I'm Nora Barrows Friedman. This episode highlights the news, interviews, and reports from our live stream broadcast on December 30th, 2025. Later in the show, we catch up with the Electronic Intifada's contributor, Abu Bakr Abed, who evacuated earlier this year from Gaza to pursue his studies in Ireland. This week on the Resistance Report, John Elmer covers Israeli assassinations of the Palestinian resistance leadership. And we speak with Ahmed Al-Naouk, a Palestinian journalist based in London, host of Palestine Deep Dive, and the director and co-founder of We Are Not Numbers. But first, we've published many features on the Electronic Intifada in the last week, but we wanted to highlight gutted Gaza buildings, a last resort for families seeking shelter, by Huda Skaik, writing from Gaza. Around Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City, entire structures and buildings lean at sharp angles, their floors and ceilings sagging as if melting, and staircases hang in midair. These rain-soaked ruins are not fit for habitation. They are so unstable that one gust of wind or a night of heavy rain could bring them down. Yet displaced people are living inside them due to a lack of tents and available space at shelters across Gaza. I went to schools and shelters, but no one accepted us, Sumaya Nabhan, 32, said. There was simply no space. I have an injured husband and 3 children. If I had a tent, even if it meant living in the street, I would choose it over this building. Before the genocide, Nabhan and her family lived in a modest single-room home in the northern Gaza Strip area of Tal el-Zaatar, but that home was destroyed by Israeli strikes. For the past 7 months, they have squatted in this tilted building in Al Rimal neighborhood, which lists so heavily to the right that visitors instinctively brace their bodies against the slope. Even the tea kettle is tilted, Nabhan said. Nabhan and her husband cleared just enough rubble to squeeze inside the building, but the roof leaks like an open pipe whenever it rains, and stray dogs wander in at night. I stay awake all night guarding my children from the dogs, she said. What does this house mean to me, she said. Shelter. Nothing in life matters more, not even food. Social media users and news outlets have documented numerous buildings collapsing in Gaza and Palestinians being trapped under the rubble of buildings that, damaged by Israeli strikes, have subsequently collapsed under winter rain. Sumaya Nabhan said the danger of living in such a structure haunts her, yet her housing options are severely limited, as 81% of all the structures in Gaza are damaged as of October 2025, according to UN analysis of satellite imagery. I live with sadness and despair, she said. Sometimes I wish for death rather than this. Her only dream now is a closed tent. I feel like I'm living somewhere unfit for humans, she said. Islam Al-Faram, 37, has pitched a tent on what used to be the front yard of her home, in between two partially collapsed structures that lean at dangerous angles. Stones fall from them, she said of the neighboring buildings. Today, stones fell on us because of the rain. Al-Faram and her husband cleared the rubble from their old home in Al-Rimal until they could erect tarps where the yard once was. They decided to stay here because this was their home, even if only the ground beneath it remains. This place holds our memories, she said. Even if we're in a tent, it feels like part of our soul is still here. Those are excerpts from Gutted Gaza Buildings, A Last Resort for Families Seeking Shelter by Huda Skaik, writing from Gaza on electronicintifada.net. Next, Ahmed Al-Naouk joins me and the Electronic Intifada's executive director, Ali Abunima.
Hi, Ahmed. How are you?
Hi.
I'm okay. Thank you very much. And thank you for inviting me again.
Thank you. Thank you, Ahmed. It's always a pleasure to see you and to have you back. And for those who know you and for those who don't know you, I'll just remind them, of course, that you are the director and co-founder of We Are Not Numbers, which is a fantastically important project helping to train and give a voice and a platform to young writers from Gaza. The Electronic Intifada is very proud that we have published many, many We Are Not Numbers writers over the years. It was a project that our dear friend Rifat Al-Arir was close to and supported as well. You grew up in Gaza, you're now based in London, and you are also the host of Palestine Deep Dive, where you engage in really fantastic in-depth conversations with notable guests from and about Palestine. And what's wonderful is that these are very in-depth discussions. So Ahmed, give us a sense right now, given the urgency of the situation, what you're hearing from friends and family right now in Gaza.
Well, I just put a question in our WhatsApp group of We Are Not Numbers, and I asked our 200 writers to comment on what they are feeling right now after 2 years of genocide. And I think only one writer responded. Her name is Taqwa, and she said, thank you. I'm quoting her, and she said, thank you for your effort, Ahmed. But I'm sorry to say that no language in the world can describe the surface of what we feel. Thank you. Another writer responded, and he said, Ahmed, we are just tired. We are tired of slogans. We're tired of statements. We're tired of social media and posts. And I believe that really depicts what the people in Gaza are feeling. They are tired. They are exhausted. They have lost hope in the world, on the media. They are tired of what is happening in Gaza. And they're tired of the world. They're very desperate. And that actually sums up what is really happening in Gaza. Me, I'm a Palestinian who lives in London. You know, just before Christmas, I moved houses. And then when I came to my new flat, I could not operate the heater and the boiler. And I was very annoyed. For a moment, I was very annoyed. And I thought, okay, it's winter, it's Christmas, I'm cold, I can't have a shower. And then another moment, I thought about the people in Gaza. The people in Gaza, they have been living in tents for the past 2 years, floods, rain, genocide, killing, murder, starvation. And I don't understand how the people in Gaza are feeling right now. And I say, language now fails us. Language fails us. It fails the Palestinians in Gaza. There are no words that can describe what is really happening in Gaza. No words can describe what the Palestinians in Gaza are feeling right now. Only a few days without hot water, without heating in London made me angry. But what the Palestinians can feel right now, I don't believe that there are some words that can suffice what the people in Gaza are feeling. And that's why maybe we have seen that the people in Gaza have reduced their activity on social media. They're not reporting as they used to in the genocide, not because the suffering is less, not because the killing is less, not because the starvation is less, but because people are depleted. People are tired. They're exhausted. They're exhausted of what they are feeling, and they're exhausted of speaking up. They're exhausted of sharing their feelings on social media because no one is feeling them. We have talked a lot about the mainstream media and how they're not covering Gaza, but also the Palestinians are tired right now.
It's very, very sobering, Ahmed. And we're always talking about how we can keep Gaza from fading out of view, of keeping up the momentum, keeping up the energy. And that's why people are here listening to us today. And what you said is very hard to hear. But at the same time, we are continuing our efforts and you are continuing your efforts. Let's focus on some of the positives or some of the strengths. What are some of the highlights from your work with We Are Not Numbers and Palestine Deep Dive over the past year that you're proud of, that you think have made a difference, that have had the potential to really educate and mobilize people? What are the kinds of things you've done and you're thinking of doing?
As I said, the people in Gaza are tired, but in We Are Not Numbers and Deep Dive, we have not tired. We have continued to speak up. We have continued to write. Our writers in Gaza and We Are Not Numbers, they have continued to speak up and they have continued to write their stories. Every day we publish a story or two on We Are Not Numbers. I'm saying this, we are tired, but we are continuing our work. We, as We Are Not Numbers, as the management of We Are Not Numbers, we do not have the luxury of tiring and being exhausted. We have to continue. This was also a message for our listeners, for the non-Palestinians. If the Palestinians one day are tired and they have all the right to be tired, you should not tire. You should speak up. You should cover what is happening in Gaza. And We Are Not Numbers, we continue to write. We Are Not Numbers book has been doing really, really well. It became an instant bestseller in the UK and in Ireland, in America. It's doing very, very well. The first print of We Are Not Numbers was sold out in the first week in the US. It is now translated into many languages, including Arabic and Japanese and Italian, and many translations are coming as well. And that says a lot. It says that the people are thirsty to hearing. And
Were you surprised by that, Ahmed, by the reaction that the book got?
I expected it will do well, but I did not expect it will do that well, to be honest. I was surprised.
This book was launched earlier in 2025, and I was very excited by that. I think this is one of the highlights of the year. What is this book for those who are hearing this for the first time?
Well, this is not my book. It is a book. It is a collection of stories that were written over the past 10 years in Gaza by 59 Palestinian young writers. Some of these writers are here with us. Some of them have been, four of our writers were killed in Gaza genocide. Most of our writers lost family members. All of them actually lived in Gaza, and they were writing their personal human stories behind the numbers that we often see in the news. So all of the stories, you'll find 74 stories written by young people in Gaza. All of them describe what it really means to be a Gazan, what it really means to live in Gaza under the blockade, under the genocide, under the wars, what it means to live and breathe the air of Gaza. It is not a gloomy book that talks about suffering and pain and destruction. It also talks about life. It also talks about what it means to being a Palestinian in Gaza. I can't say it's a hard read. It's a very illuminating read. When you read it, you will not be the same, because you will hear the very personal stories of the people in Gaza who are young, who are not affiliated with any political party, who are just young people who are writing their hearts out to the world. One of my favorite stories in We Are Not Numbers is a story written by my friend Anas Jnainan. The title of that story is I Want the World to Know. And he says that he wants the world to know that Gaza, that we Palestinians are neither victims nor heroes. We are just the humans like you who live, who love, who laugh, who go to doctors, who go to school, who hand naively written love letters to their girlfriends and all of that. But that is something that we really focus on in our work and We Are Not Numbers. We are fighting the dehumanization of the Palestinian people. And when I say we fight the dehumanization of the Palestinian people, I don't only mean the dehumanization of the Palestinian people by the mainstream media or by the Zionists or by our enemies, but also by our friends who think of us as we are superheroes, as if we have supernatural powers. No, we're not that. We're neither victims, we're nor heroes. We are just human beings who are striving to live under occupation, under this humiliation. We are, yes, we are heroes, we are victims, but we're not this or that. We are all of them at the same time. If you go to Gaza, if you go to Palestine, you will find people who are amazing, wonderful heroes, like my brother, like my family. You will find also some collaborators who work with Israel. But with We Are Not Numbers, we try to depict the whole of the picture about Palestine, all of it. We do not try to exclude one aspect of life in Gaza. And that, I believe, that is very important for our allies as well. Do not expect that we will be resilient forever. Do not expect that we will be superheroes, that we will alone fight occupation and win eventually. No, we are a group of people. We have our downsides and we have our heroes, but we also need help from the international community. Mm-hmm. I say that the Palestinian cause is not a cause for only the Palestinians. It is a cause for humanity, for everyone who cares about justice and freedom. And we want everyone to be involved in this cause. And if they are going to be involved, they need to understand Palestine as it is, without over-glorification of the Palestinian people and without the dehumanization of the Palestinian people.
Human beings don't have to be perfect to have rights.
Exactly.
You know, exactly. Because there is this discourse, this really poisonous discourse about Palestine that it comes not just from Donald Trump and, you know, open enemies of Palestinian rights, but even from so-called friends. The Palestinians have to jump through all these hoops before they can deserve their rights or statehood or self-determination. No. Palestinians are allowed to be imperfect and still have their rights. They don't have to be perfect victims. It is an extraordinary book, Ahmed, and I love it. And that piece by Anas Jnene is one of the really most charming pieces in this. And there are many pieces that are hard to read, many that are very funny. I laughed a lot when I read a lot of the pieces in this book.
I see it in every bookstore here, you know, in on the West Coast that I walk into. And it's just, it's not surprising that it's getting such phenomenal reception, but it's comforting that it is out there and more people are reading it and giving it to their family members, donating it to libraries. It's remarkable. And it speaks to the incredible amount of work that you and your colleagues have done at We Are Not Numbers. My mom is a mentor with We Are Not Numbers. She's been working with poets in Gaza. And I know that that's been such a privilege for her and for so many other people around the world who are mentoring and working with writing students there. I think it's provided a real lifeline for people outside of Gaza to be able to work on something collectively and not just sit back and watch helplessly. And I think your book and your project does that so well, Ahmed. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And I have to say that this book made it out there. It succeeded despite efforts of our enemy to silence it, to destroy the book. I remember when We Are Not Numbers was first launched last year, many Zionist organizations started to attack the retailers and the bookshops that are selling We Are Not Numbers, because I am one of the co-authors. And despite all of that, We Are Not Numbers did well, and it was everywhere. I've seen people read it from Europe to the UK, America, and even in Italy, in Italian, Arabic, and Japanese, and so many other people are reading it in many other languages. And this is what the Palestinian people, I have to say it again, it's not my book. This is a book of the Palestinian people. 59 young writers from Gaza who contributed in this book, and they deserve their voices to be out there. One of the writers who wrote one of these stories is my brother Mahmoud, who was 25 years old when Israel killed him. And people like Mahmoud, people like Yusuf Dawaz, people like Muhammad Hammo, who were killed in this genocide, they deserve their stories to be out there. They deserve to be read. And this is the least you can do to the Palestinian people, is to read their stories, is to immortalize them in your bookshelves, in your libraries, in your mind. Read the Palestinian stories.
Thank you so much, Ahmed. I second every word of that. And we're so grateful to you for all your work. And just to encourage people again to check out the We Are Not Numbers website. Also, of course, we are very proud that many We Are Not Numbers writers are also featured at the Electronic Intifada, like that recent piece that Dora shared by Huda Skek. She is one, and there are many others as well. And of course, the fantastic conversations you're having regularly at Palestine Deep Dive, easy to find, just search for Palestine Deep Dive. We will continue watching, Ahmed, we'll continue learning from you, and we hope and pray for better news, for a better future for everyone in Gaza and Palestine. And in the meantime, stay strong. Keep up the amazing work you and your colleagues are doing.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
That was Ahmed Al-Nauk. For more, check out wearenotnumbers.org. You're listening to Electronic Intifada Radio with me, Nora Barrows-Friedman. Still to come on Electronic Intifada Radio, we go to Ireland to speak with a Palestinian journalist about hope and a yellow rose. But before we get to that, the Electronic Intifada's John Elmer reports on the deaths of senior commanders from the Palestinian resistance.
This is the resistance report for day 816 of Israel's genocide and day 82. Since the ceasefire agreement has been signed, of course, it's been violated now almost 1,000 times. 420 people have been killed, 298 of them in direct gunshot deaths by Israeli soldiers shooting Palestinians along the yellow line. But yesterday, there was news spoken from the new Qassam Brigade spokesperson announcing the deaths of senior commanders, including Abu Obeida. And I know many people were wondering about this for a long time. We did not report on this because we didn't have information on it. We wait until the resistance can confirm. But Abu Obeida was assassinated back in the summer, and they announced it today. The new spokesperson for the Qassam Brigades, he spoke about something that I remember Rafat talking about. He says that we boast of belonging to Gaza. I remember Rafat used to be so proud of being from Shujaiya, and when he would tell people where he was from, he was so proud of it. And the new spokesperson for the Qassam Brigades began by saying that we boast of belonging to Gaza. He reiterated that October 7th was an explosion in the face of injustice, oppression, and siege that awakened the conscience of the free peoples of the world and exposed Israel as a Nazi occupation with its sadistic crimes and genocide, making it a fugitive from criminal justice. He said that the resistance thwarted all of Israel's plans, from expulsion to concentration camps to the death trap aid program, right through to the promise to resettle, which is, of course, not happening. And we covered all those on the resistance report over these past 2 years, right? People remember the general's plan that was supposed to drive everybody out of North Gaza. Those plans didn't come into effect. And that was because of the resistance and the steadfastness of the people of Gaza. Abu Obeida said, "We denied Israel's goals that were to defeat the resistance in the spirit of resistance. Israel failed to return their captives through violence, but required negotiation and prisoner exchange after the shadow unit of the Qassam Brigades protected the captives bravely during the battle. The ceasefire was because of the steadfastness of our people and our fighters who never left their posts." Abu Obeida said, "Our people will defend themselves and will not give up their weapons as long as the occupation remains. They will not surrender, even if they have to fight with their fingernails," he said. And he said, "In our fighters trapped in Rafah, you have the best witness and proof of that." He talked about Israel's pillars are shaking and its foundations are eroding, and that is a harbinger of its demise, he said. "Justice will prevail and we will rebuild together what the occupation has destroyed," is what he said to the people of Gaza. "Its sons will not drop the banner until victory." And then he said, "I have inherited the title of Abu Obeida." That was a significant moment. It also happened with Islamic Jihad. Their spokesperson, Abu Hamza, who was assassinated, was replaced and they kept the same name. The name Abu Obeida comes from an early military figure in Muslim war fighting. He was a companion of the Prophet and a key military commander in early Islam fighting, the first Muslim battle, and stacking victories ultimately until he became the chief of the conquest of Mecca. So the roots of the name Abu Obeida are deep. Abu Obeida participated in the Battle of Uhud, which is the focal point of a number of resistance videos that we've seen where the fighters quoted poems or in other ways alluded to that battle to remain on the Mountain of Archers. Abu Ubaidah did remain on the Mountain of Archers after the Muslim forces had fled the attack by Khalid bin Walid's forces. So he did stay on the Mountain of Archers and he defended the Prophet while he was up there. So the name and the convention of that has deep roots. And so that's why they will carry on with that name. So that is the first speech from the new spokesman for the Qassam Brigades, announcing they were announcing the deaths of Muhammad Sinwar, Abu Ibrahim, who is the chief of staff of the Qassam Brigades, Ra'ed Saad, who was the head of military manufacturing, Hakim Al-Isa, Abu Omar, who was the head of the Weapons Support and Combat Services Department, along with Muhammad Shabana, who was the commander of the Rafa Brigade, and then Abu Ubaidah Hudhaifa Al-Khalut. And he was, of course, more than just a spokesperson. He was the head of the military media apparatus. He was involved in the battle. They did individual posters for each of them. That's Muhammad Sinwar, the brother of Yahya Sinwar, who has a long military history within the Qassam Brigades going back to its earliest days. Abu Ubaidah described him as a man of unique intellect. He was the leader of the Khan Yunis Brigades before becoming operations chief for the Qassam Brigades. And then after the assassination of Muhammad al-Daif, he became the chief of staff for the Qassam Brigades since the summer of 2024 and commanded the battle without any observable impact, which I think is important to note about all of these assassinations, is that these are key leadership figures that were assassinated, but at no point did we notice that in the war that the fighting in any way was indicative of any kind of replacement chaos or anything of the sort. In fact, there was no way of telling that at all, which I think is a tribute to the organization, a tribute to the people who are coming up underneath these figures, that they can be replaced and carry on the job, which the Qassam Brigades did fighting in Gaza after Muhammad Sinwar was killed this past summer. Muhammad Shabana, he was the Rafa Brigade's commander, and he was killed along Sinwar in Khan Yunis. When he was killed, 26 civilians were killed along with them, which is the case in all of these assassinations. In fact, in all of the assassinations going back decades of Qassam and Hamas figures, there's always civilian massacres along with that, even though there's an option to not have that be the case. So Muhammad Shabana was an important position. He was very close to Ra'ed al-Attar, who was the leader of Qassam in the south. And in that period of time in the south, Rafa was a significantly important command because of the tunnel trade in and out in that era. And also there was a number of significant special forces operations that were led from the south, of course, most notably the Gilad Shalit capture, the capture of the Israeli tank gunner in 2006. Mohammed Shabana's fingerprints were all over that operation. And he contributed across all departments. So he was a senior figure in media, in logistics, and special forces. And ultimately, it was Shabana who purchased hundreds of cameras and hard drives for the military media apparatus to watch it grow. Also, two of his sons were Nukba fighters, elite fighters that were killed during the Battle of Rafah, which is often the case with these fighters. Their families are involved deeply in the struggle and have for multiple generations. So that is the case with Muhammad Shabana as well. Ra'ed Saad, he was killed in an assassination earlier this month while driving in Gaza City, complete violation of the ceasefire. The Americans said they were going to look into that, but they didn't look into it. And as we heard Trump yesterday saying, that he has no problems with anything Israel's doing. So that's a harbinger of the way that Israel plans to carry forth in Gaza, that carry out these assassinations whenever they want, which sets up a very fraught dynamic for a ceasefire to hold. Ra'ed Saad was the first ever Gaza Brigade commander, Gaza City, when they were setting those up after the Second Intifada, during and after the Second Intifada, when they were really, the Qassam Brigades were moving from an operatives-based organization to really a rooted military structure. And Ra'ed Saad was critical in that development as well. He was operations chief in the 2010s. And then ultimately the commander of military manufacturing, which produced the locally made weapons that were used on October 7th and for the two-year defense of Gaza. And we saw those weapons that were built in Gaza not run out for the battle, and it ends up being a key part of the story. Hakim al-Issa, he was a builder in the Qassam military academies, the war.